Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Well, now that 3 days of Supreme Court arguments over the health care law have been completed, what will happen? Ezra Klein from The Washington Post's Wonk blog joins us to begin digesting the intense 6 hours of arguments. Hi, Ezra. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning.
So this whole thing seems to turn on the argument that the Affordable Care Act isn't regulating commerce. It's doing something else to commerce, namely creating it. That's the heart of the matter, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's funny. All this depends on how you frame it, right? For the bill's defenders, the entire argument is that, of course, it is regulating commerce. That is exactly what it is doing. These are all regulations. I spoke
which the Constitution allows, we should say.
Which the Constitution
explicitly
allows.
So gives Congress the power to regulate interstate commerce.
Charles Fried is Ronald Reagan's Solicitor General. He's at Harvard now. He's a very, very respected constitutional lawyer. And I spoke to him yesterday, and it was almost hilarious talking to him because he just thought this was the most absurd thing he had ever seen in his life. He just said, look, is health care an interstate market? It is. Is this a regulation of health care? It is. So is it constitutional? It is. End of story.
Period.
And you almost just imagine him walking up into the Supreme Court, doing that and then dropping the mic and walking out. It almost seemed like Obama should have had Reagan's Solicitor General arguing the case. But as you say, on the other side of this argument, there's an effort to make a distinction that, no, you know, asking people to buy private health insurance is not a regulation of existing commerce. It is an effort to create commerce in a new way. Now, one thing that should be said here, Akhil Rita Marr, who's a Yale law professor and a constitutional scholar, says, we have done this before. He made this point to me yesterday. He said, look, we had in 1792 the Militia Act, and what the Militia Act said is that you have to go out and buy privately a musket, an ammunition pack, and a knapsack for keeping it. And the idea was that's how we're going to create a well-regulated militia, but that was also, you know, forcing people to engage in commerce they might not otherwise have engaged
right.
in.
Right, and that was never enforced, but it was also never challenged as unconstitutional.
Right.
And
nobody
so it seems like a direct precedent.
Exactly.
It's also an interesting Second Amendment argument, right? Talk about a limiting principle. The right to bear arms, oh, by the way, really was for the sake of a militia, not so you can stalk a kid with Skittles who looks suspicious in your
right.
gated
well, that,
community.
That's a different and troubling point
that's
as well.
That's a different show.
But one thing that I think is also worth thinking about here is that we are really arguing over a very, very unusual kind of technicality. Because here's what everybody agrees is constitutional. Everybody, including Randy Barnett, who's a key legal thinker behind the sort of legal challenge to the Obama health care bill. If the government passes a law, and what they do is they raise my taxes and your taxes and all of our taxes by, you know, whatever, a couple thousand dollars, and in return, they purchase us a health care plan, right, either from a private company or from Medicare, that is constitutional. And it is constitutional even to go one step more removed, one step closer to the individual mandate, and raise my taxes, and then if I buy a health care plan, give me a tax credit for the same amount. That is how Paul Ryan's health care plan worked, actually.
Now, aren't they arguing? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
The only question is whether or not we can do essentially the same thing through different means, through
right.
somewhat more straightforward means that, oddly enough, includes less government intrusion.
Right. And I had raised that Ryan Care parallel on the show the other day with a guest, and she said, you know, Ezra Klein wrote the same thing in the Washington Post. So we were thinking along the same lines on that. But Ryan claims, I think, that the difference is that his plan includes a public option so that the senior citizens, if his plan were to be enacted, would not be forced only to buy a private Medicare plan on the private market, but they could stay in traditional Medicare, and that's the exception.
I'm actually talking about a different Ryan plan. So you're talking about his Medicare reforms. I'm talking about the plan that was in his roadmap, and it was also, I believe, another health care plan sponsored by Tom Coburn alongside
okay.
Paul Ryan, and that would have been in the under 65 market and would have,
uh-huh.
of course, had no public option because Ryan would sooner be, you know, he's not a big fan of public options, if he can help it. So this would be for the exact same market as the Obama Affordable Care Act.
So, listeners, you are the 10th justice, okay? You've heard these 3 days of arguments. Time to issue your opinions. Do you keep the whole law or just strike down the mandate or throw the whole thing out? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post it to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And because we are in Wonk World here with Ezra Klein, if you decide to keep the whole law, we are going to ask, what is your limiting principle? That was the vocabulary term for the week, in addition to severability. In other words, if the federal government can make you buy health insurance, why can't it just make you buy anything? 212. Hang on. 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692. Listeners, you are the 10th justice. How would you vote? And what would your limiting principle be? And just to illustrate this idea, and then Ezra, you say whatever you want. It is this idea that the justices seem to be the most obsessed with on Tuesday, this limiting principle. If Congress can force you to buy one thing, what's to stop it from sliding down a slippery slope to credit card tyranny, forcing you to buy lots of things, like?
Can the government require you to buy a cell phone because that would facilitate responding when you need emergency services?
And if you don't have burial insurance or you haven't saved money for it, you're going to shift the cost to somebody else.
Like a car or broccoli.
Broccoli. I'll
tell you what the something else is. The something else is everybody has to exercise.
Various justices, ending with Scalia, on the limiting principle. Ezra, what did you want to say?
Rita Marr, again, the CL professor, I thought made a very eloquent point on this limiting principle issue. I mean, we can talk about limiting principles. He thinks there is one in this bill. But one thing he said that is really getting lost here is that the key limiting principle, the key way that we actually limit what happens in our government in this country, and we fought for it in the Revolutionary War, is that we elect the people who make these decisions. So, you know, when we created an amendment allowing an income tax, right, that wasn't originally allowed in the Constitution. There was a lot of argumentation over whether or not, well, if we allow an income tax, won't the Congress just raise the income tax to 100%, right? And then we have communism. And it's true. They could do that. There is no limit saying that the income tax has to be below 100% of all income. The limit is that they won't. The limit is that we would vote them out of office. And so it's just important to say that, yes, there are absurd things a government could do with its power. But the check on most of them is not the Constitution in an everyday way. The check on them is voters. And by the way, that's how this works in the states, right? We allow states to do individual mandates. There's one in Massachusetts. And if people don't like them, they vote people out. And we don't see a lot of tyranny in Massachusetts.
And they haven't tried to make you buy cell phones or burial services or broccoli. It's that far-fetchedness that I mentioned on yesterday's show about all these examples. If they are so concerned about a limiting principle, they actually didn't come up with one hypothetical that was remotely likely to happen.
Right. I mean, it would be very odd for a member of Congress to put forward the coercive Broccoli Consumption Act of 2015.
Yeah.
He could do it, and arguably under certain constitutional arguments, it would even be constitutional. The check is that we would vote him out of office because, you know what? You know, Brent, I actually like broccoli. I just ate some broccoli the other day, but I don't want the government telling me I have to eat broccoli, and so I'd vote him out of office. That is a power we have. We have more checks against governmental tyranny than just the Constitution, and that's how the Constitution is written. It's not supposed to be it's not our only bulwark against tyranny in this country.
How about asparagus? Now that's much better than broccoli. I think you'll agree.
I completely disagree.
Oh, unbelievable.
And see, in a country like this, we would never be able even to agree on which vegetable we need to coerce people to eat.
It's just more reason that we have to mandate asparagus. I think that this was Don Verrilli's main failure, by the way, to be perfectly serious, the White House Solicitor General. He could have, in a clear-voiced, simple way, the way Akhil Reed Amar and Charles Freed did to you for your blog, say, people, healthcare is 17% of the U.S. economy. It's obviously interstate commerce, and the individual mandate is just part of this law to regulate it. The Constitution doesn't tell us how to regulate it. It just says, go regulate commerce. And there would be the soundbite for the media to play over and over again as that side's argument, and he didn't give it to us.
it's a strange thing about his performance. And, you know, I feel terrible for Don Verrilli. I mean, he did a terrible job as well. And it was a very high stakes, terrible job. But, you know, people have bad days, right? And they just, it came at the wrong time. But this is a guy who's argued 17 cases before the Supreme Court. And if you read profiles of him before, one thing people said about him is that he's incredibly good at sort of speaking in common terms, right? He's able to take these arcane judicial principles and translate them down into common sense, into real world examples. He was not able to do that. I mean, I read that transcript, and it was, I understand this stuff pretty well, and I found what he was saying incredibly arcane and incredibly sort of like trying to slice a salami ever thinner. I think to some degree, Justice Kennedy threw him off by questioning him quite hostilely and setting terms of the questioning that were hard for him to answer. But I agree, you know, he should have just said, listen, we don't at all accept the argument you're making that this is somehow unprecedented. This is a very straightforward regulation. We continuously use the tax power in this country to incentivize people to do things. This is an idea Republicans thought of as a way to keep single payer from happening, as a way to be able to regulate the national health care market such that the government didn't have to take the whole thing over. And there is nothing unconstitutional about it. This is an open and shut case.
All right, listeners, you are the 10th Justice with Ezra Klein, Washington Post columnist, and he writes their Wonk blog. We'll continue with your calls, more clips from the week, and more of our thoughts after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Ezra Klein, Washington Post columnist, as we debrief the Supreme Court health care arguments, try to figure out if we should mandate asparagus or broccoli, figure out which Ryan plan we're actually talking about, and lots of things like that. But listeners, you are the 10th Justice. Antonia in East Hampton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Antonia.
Hello. Thank you, Brian, for taking my call.
Thank you.
I guess the first person...
Are you on vacation, by the way? Because you usually call as Antonia from Jersey City, right?
Yes, indeed. Right now, I'm actually in Emerson, New Jersey. Somehow, it got confused. I'm only a little bit further up from Jersey
City. Okay, I had it as East Hampton. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. I like the social promotion aspect of that. Regarding the statute, the first thing is, it would have been clear that if they had taxed us directly, this would have been completely legitimate as a single-payer system, which is where I come from.
Politically untenable, but constitutional without question.
Right, but politically perhaps tenable if it was actually managed properly. Two, the profit margin that is allowed for the insurance companies is egregious. Medicare has a loss ratio of approximately 8% and obviously does not have a profit.
I don't want to get into all the policy of the law. I want to stay on these constitutional questions for today. Do you want
to
go there?
Next question. Yes, I do. My next question then goes to what happens to people who never use medical services. For example, there's a religious group called Christian Scientists. As an atheist, I don't ascribe to that, but they have the right, as I understand it, to refuse medical care for themselves, perhaps not for their children. If they do not take medical care, why would they be forced?
Okay, and I'm going to leave it there. And Ezra, this is a reasonable question. Mm-hmm. Why should Congress be able to force Christian Scientists who don't even believe in health insurance to buy health insurance?
It didn't. That's the important thing here. There is an exemption for religious reasons, and there's also, importantly, people don't talk about this that much, there is an exemption for affordability. So if purchasing health care insurance would be unaffordable, right, it'd be more than 8% of your income, you don't have to do it. So quite a few people would actually be free from the mandate entirely.
Alan in West Orange, you're on WNYC. Hello, Alan.
Hi. Thanks very much. I haven't heard any argument that the prescription program as part of Medicare requires everyone to be a part of that program. And if they fail to enroll when they want to get into it, eventually they have to pay a tax or a penalty for every year that they haven't been in since it went into effect. That was constitutional when the Republicans put that through under Bush. Why isn't that an argument before the Supreme Court? I haven't seen that. And Second, McCullough versus Maryland, I think, puts this whole case to rest. There's nothing wrong with doing what they're doing as long as it's not prescribed by the Constitution.
Thank you very much. McCullough versus Maryland. And, you know, Ezra, there was very little precedent cited. There was so much hypothetical. What if they tried to regulate broccoli? What if this? But there was very little case law actually cited, and McCullough versus Maryland was one of the few.
Well, it's actually an interesting difference between the performances of Clement and Verrilli. Paul Clement being the for the GOP side, or for the anti-mandate side, the chief lawyer. And everything the justices said to him, he had like nine precedents. I mean, he was just putting them down on the table one after the other. And Verrilli was letting justices trap him in these kind of hypotheticals. But as you say, McCullough versus Maryland is this very, very important case. And Akhil Reed Amar, I don't want to try to explain it in too great detail because I don't feel I'll do it justice. But Akhil Reed Amar, when we spoke yesterday, he said, the thing I would tell people to do is read McCulloch versus Maryland, and then reread McCulloch versus Maryland, and then read it again, and read it until you understand it. And you can find this case online, and in it, essentially, Chief Justice Madison says the way the Constitution works is it in its foresight and in the wisdom of the founders, they did not try to foresee every eventuality. They did not try to tell us exactly what we would and wouldn't be able to do, because they knew perfectly well they were building a country they intended it to endure for centuries or millennia, and we would have to deal with exigencies they didn't foresee. So they gave us a Constitution that was practical, that we could understand, that set limits on things they were particularly worried about, elements of tyranny they were particularly worried about, but that nevertheless gave Congress the freedom and the capacity to be pragmatic when it needed to and find ways to do the things it needed to do on key issues, and one of those key issues, of course, being the regulation of interstate commerce for the free flow of goods and labor.
Tim in Hillsboro, you're on WNYC, and you're the 10th Justice. Hello.
Good morning. Obviously, this whole premise is to make everyone have health care, and that really disincentivizes the whole process. They're going to turn doctors and healthcare workers and hospitals into firefighters and police officers and people who are now not willing to accept the amount of money they're going to be receiving as a police officer, as a firefighter. They're civil servants. They're turning doctors into civil servants.
Except that, Tim, the Obama folks would argue that that's exactly what they decided not to do by not passing a single-payer plan. Instead, this is all happening in the private marketplace as pertains to the mandate. People are required to get private insurance, and then you're dealing with Aetna or Cigna or Empire,
but it's really not.
Doctors.
You just said a few minutes ago that if you make X number of dollars, you don't have to have your health care. You have to purchase health care. You're going to get it for free. So they're really taking the bottom part of society.
But just you're getting private insurance for free.
No, but not if you're getting private insurance for free, basically by the government. The government, the taxpayer, is going to be the one paying for it. The middle class is getting squeezed dramatically. If I was a 21-year-old kid today, what incentive do I have to do anything? I could live in subsidized housing. I could get free health care. I could make less than $20,000 a year and not pay any taxes. Yeah. Why would I want to do anything other than just have a menial job?
But the Obama argument is that 21-year-old is the slacker today when it comes to health insurance. If they have a job and they're not buying health insurance because they don't consider themselves at risk, then for people who actually are more poor and more sick, then you, the middle-class older taxpayer, then you're getting squeezed. Under the mandate, all those young, healthy people have to pay into this system.
But if they make less than a certain amount of money, just like you said a few minutes ago, they're not going to have to pay anything. And that's the whole problem. And there's no incentive for these young kids to do anything. So these 21-year-olds who are making $20,000 a year, that don't pay any taxes, that don't have any worries about health care, they're going to get it for free. They get their housing for free. They probably get food stamps as well if they're making $20,000. So that 21-year-old in 25 years is now a 46-year-old who is in the same boat and in the same situation and now needs health care.
Tim, thank you very much. So this is the Paul Ryan argument. The safety net turns into a hammock. As
a culture of dependency. You know, I think that there's a, I guess to put it in a phrase, it's not very fun to be poor. I mean, it's just not. if you're very, very poor, it's true, you can get Medicaid. And under the health care bill, that will be easier in some ways. But the reason people try not to be poor is that they don't want to be poor. They want to have money to go out and do things. They want that 21-year-old wants to be able to take a girl on a date occasionally. And when you go out and you offer that food stamp, it's not a good situation. He doesn't, and affordable housing is, as you know well, Brian, not always such a sure thing. So, you know, we have not seen in this country any real evidence that health care is what's keeping people from getting into the job market, that when we give folks Medicaid, that after that they don't want a job because they're content to sit at home forever. What we have seen is the opposite of that. We have seen that it's quite common that because people can't change their job, because their job gives them health care and they're locked into it because maybe they or their daughter has a pre-existing condition, they can't go and take a new job. And we have seen that, unlike in other countries like France and Germany, where they do have these sort of universal systems that the caller is worried about, where they pay, you know, in terms of healthcare expenditures per person, $3,000 or $4,000 less per year than we do. We have found that healthcare is making us very uncompetitive against them. So in terms of what the healthcare system is doing, I think it is widely understood by economists of both parties, even if they would disagree on what the exact cause is, that our healthcare system, which does in fact give people a lot more incentive to not be poor because you often can't get subsidized healthcare if you're young, it has been terrible for the American economy and terrible for American competitiveness. In terms of incentives, our last problem is that we haven't gone far enough towards making our healthcare system difficult for the uninsured or the low-income folks to navigate.
We're debriefing the 3 days of arguments about the health reform law with Ezra Klein, Washington Post columnist. He writes their Wonk blog on their website. And you, as the 10th justice, how would you rule in this case? Mike in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Oh, great. Hi. Good morning. Yeah, I'm for the health care law, but the one point of the law that really has me frustrated has to do with Scalia's comment where he equates the mandate to forcing consumers to purchase broccoli or cars, because I believe it's a false and inaccurate analogy, and either he doesn't understand or he's being purposely dense when he makes that analogy. And my reason is, if an individual doesn't buy broccoli or a car, that decision doesn't have an effect on an individual who does decide to buy a broccoli or a car, unless at some point in time in the future that person has to have broccoli and a car and the rest of us have to pay for it.
So what's your limiting principle, to go back to that argument? Why couldn't, under the Constitution, if the justices approve this law, Congress, at some future date, if it was politically acceptable, mandate that you buy broccoli? Why couldn't they?
I believe that the argument that the journalist has been making is the limiting principle, and the fact that we elect these people. You're dealing with a common sense to a certain extent that Congress has decided to make a rule that is governing 17% of the economy. And, you know, we elect these people.
Mike, thank you very much. The big issue yesterday, and I want to touch on this, Ezra, was severability. Could the rest of the law stand if the mandate is struck down? And I think this revealed how much the justices, maybe on both sides, really care about health insurance here, not just about what the Constitution says as a conceptual matter. Here's Justice Ginsburg arguing, don't be judicial activists, as she sees it. Don't start dismantling more of the law than we all might find unconstitutional.
Why shouldn't we say it's a choice between a wrecking operation, which is what you are requesting, or a salvage job? And the more conservative approach would be salvage rather than throwing out everything.
So, Justice Ginsburg, but Justice Kennedy, and of course he's the presumed swing voter on the court, he saw judicial activism very differently.
Please.
Judicial restraint, you are echoing the earlier premise that it increases the judicial power if the judiciary strikes down other provisions of the Act. I suggested to you it might be quite the opposite. We would be exercising the judicial power if one act was one provision was stricken and the other remained, to impose a risk on insurance companies that Congress had never intended. By reason of this court, we would have a new regime that the Congress did not provide for, did not consider.
That, it seems to me, can be argued at least to be a more extreme exercise of judicial power than to strike than the striking the whole.
So, Ezra, to me, that was a fascinating.
Absolutely.
You know, couple of they didn't come right back to back, really, but a fascinating contrast because it raises this question of which is judicial activism and which is judicial restraint. Is it to throw out the whole law? That seems like the most extreme thing that they could do, rather than go bit by bit and see which parts were actually unconstitutional. But as you heard, Justice Kennedy argued it exactly the other way, and he seemed to believe it.
I think that you can detect in that exchange a limiting principle that speaks to the earlier caller's comments. And I want to say before I offer this principle that I'm really with Akhil Reed Amar on this. I think that, to use another example, if there's a world 15 years in the future where you're under constant threat of biological attack for some awful reason and Congress wants to mandate that people buy a cell phone and the country thinks that's a good idea, that's popular, and so Congress passes it and those people are reelected and the law stands, I don't think there's reason to think that the founders would find that a horrible thing. I don't think there's reason to believe that's unconstitutional. But if you do want this limiting principle, I think the way to look at it is exactly what Kennedy and Ginsburg are worried about here. Healthcare is an unusual market, and it isn't, to get away from the broccoli analogy, it is not the same as being healthy. Health insurance, which is the way we pay for health care, has a problem called an adverse death spiral. And the way the adverse spiral works is that the healthy people, the healthy 21-year-old, who far from being a slacker is making a good decision not to buy health care because he doesn't need it right now, stays out of the market until he's sick. And then he comes in, and then he raises everybody's premiums. And the problem is that if you don't have ways to get all the healthy people into the market, what you have is that sick people come into the market, prices go up a bit. Then the top layer of healthy people, the very healthiest people, leave because they think, you know what, the prices just went up a little bit. I don't need this at all. So they walk out. Then prices go up a bit more. Then the next layer of healthy people leave. Then they go up a bit more. The next layer of healthy people leave. This is called an insurance death spiral, and it is something that happens in healthcare insurance markets and doesn't happen elsewhere. So one limiting principle some economists have argued for is that if you have to, I mean, the reason this is necessary for regulating interstate commerce in the health insurance market and not in others is that if you don't have a mandate in the health insurance market, the market collapses in on itself. And that's why what the actual administration has asked the Supreme Court to do is not what Ginsburg has said, right? They have not said, come in, take out the mandate, and leave everything else alone and let us figure out. They've actually said, if you're going to take out the mandate, take out some of these other insurance regulations like guaranteed issue that forces insurance companies to give health care to anybody without worrying about pre-existing conditions. But I think in that moment right there, you actually see what makes health insurance different than other markets, and something that I don't think really explained that clearly, and I don't think it's been explained that clearly in the popular debate here.
That's an interesting point. And the insurance industry does have a legitimate concern here, right? If the mandate dies, it is unfair for the law to still require them to provide all this new expensive coverage, like for all pre-existing conditions at standard community rates, without the funding mechanism that was going to pay for it. But there's also a constitutional irony there, I think, and that is it may protect insurance companies from being unfairly ordered to do things, but not protect Americans from unfairly becoming destitute because they're sick.
Right. There's an odd moment in the transcript where Kennedy says, you know, it'd be really radical if we put insurance companies in this position. And I thought, my God, it would be really radical if you decided it was unconstitutional to give 30 million Americans health care insurance through a mechanism that, frankly, over the last 20 years has been proposed by both parties. Obviously, the individual mandate was originally a Republican idea. I thought there was an odd level of concern for the insurance companies, which, to be fair, it's not just unfair to force them to do this. It won't work in the long run. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, there was somewhat less concern I found for the radicalism of saying, look, Congress has finally found a way to give 30 million people health care insurance, and we're going to really, based on very arguable, on a party line vote in the Supreme Court, take it away.
You are the 10th Justice, David and Howell. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning, Brian. I love your show.
Thank you.
Ezra was making the point before of saying that having these people on the ballot is what's going to keep them from doing outrageous things. For example, they can raise our taxes to 100%, but they know they'll get voted out. But I think that works the other way, because they have the power to tax us. Look at how the divisions, and, you know, tax the rich, tax the middle class, and it's made it almost impossible to vote some of these guys out. If a guy says, I'm going to keep all the however many millions of people don't pay taxes, I'm not going to raise your taxes, even though the country's broke, you know, these guys are all going to vote for that guy. So it really works the other way, that give them more power, even though technically we can vote them out. but it really gives them the power of not allowing us to vote them out anymore, and they have so much power over us.
David, thank you. All right, we've been totally serious and wonky on healthcare for a half hour. Let's end with the hilarious question, the obviously hilarious question of whether it's unconstitutionally coercive to require states to expand their Medicaid rolls or lose all federal Medicaid funding. Now, that may not sound funny on its face, but believe it or not, this begins with Jack Benny, the old comedian, and then goes to Justice Scalia. Jack Benny first.
Hey, Bud. Bud.
Huh?
Got a match?
Match? Yes, I have one right here.
Don't make a move. This is a stick-up.
Mister, put down that gun.
Shut up. Now, come on. Your money or your life? Look, Bud. I said your money or your life. I'm thinking it over.
The old Jack Benny thing, your money or your life. And, you know, he says, I'm thinking. It's funny because it's no choice. You know, your life is just money. It's an easy choice. No coercion. Right? I mean, right? Now, whereas if the choice were your life or your wife's, that's a lot harder. Now, is it coercive in both situations?
Well, yes, it is.
Really?
I mean,
it's a tough choice in the later.
I thought you were going to say this statute is your money and your life.
Yeah, well, and it is, but I mean, I.
Which way?
I might have missed something, but both of those seem to be the
no, whole no, no. To say you. When you say you're coerced, it means you've been given an offer you can't refuse. Okay, you can't refuse your money or your life, but your life or your wife's, I could refuse that one.
Let's leave the wife.
Mr. Clemente, he's not going home tonight.
Let's leave the wife out.
Saying it the other way. I was going to say, Mrs. Clemente.
No, I'm talking about my life. I say, take mine. You know.
I wouldn't do that either.
I couldn't use that example. Forget about it.
It's enough frivolity for a while, but
Chief Justice Roberts, the grown-up in the room, putting an end to that with that's enough frivolity for a while. So, Ezra Klein, in our last 30 seconds, I guess we have learned, if nothing else, that Justice Scalia would sacrifice his life for his wife, but he makes it sound like maybe he wouldn't.
Well, I think I think we can at least say that Justice Benny has had an unusually large impact on this case.
Jack Benny, the 10th Justice, and you all, you can continue your 10th Justice posts at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer's show. Ezra Klein writes the Wonk blog for The Washington Post at WashingtonPost.com. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, we conclude our popular series on sleep with Alice Park and your slumber stories and your calls on what keeps you up at night and how you get your Z's. Stay with us.